You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning into KBOO Portland.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Originally from India, now in D.C., from Brazil, we have Abhay K. And he is going to read an opening poem.
Soul Song. This was my first poem. I was always here as blowing wind or falling leaves. As shining sun or flowing streams, as blooming buds or chirping birds, as blue sky or empty space, I was never born, I didn't die.
Abhay K, and he is our special poet today. Tell us about the philosophy behind that poem and all of your poetry.
This is at the heart of Indian philosophy, that each of us have souls. Our bodies die, we pass away, but our souls, they do not. They're immortal. And this poem came to me while I was walking in Delhi University, and I felt as soul itself is speaking to me, telling me about its immortality. And I remember when I was in school, I used to study Sanskrit, and there was a sloka, Sanskrit sloka. A sloka is a poem. Nanam chindanti sastrani, nanam dahati pavaka, nanam kledyati, nanam sosayati maruta. Which had the same essence, that the soul cannot be burned in fire, it cannot be pierced by any weapon, it cannot be wet by water, it cannot be dried by air. And I think that essence comes in this poem.
It is absolutely beautiful. So give us another poem. Abhay K.
Come. Come as monsoon rains to a parched land of summer, or softly as spring, with new leaves and bird song. Come roaring as a volcano, exuding plumes of gas and lava, or shaking with great force as an earthquake. Come gently as sea breeze, or stealthily as a lover at night. Come playing flute as Krishna or Kali with a garland of skulls. Come exploding as a supernova or as a black hole devouring all, come as elixir of life or as death nectar.
What I like so much are your word choices, which are like lullabies, and then you surprise us in the middle with very muscular words like exploding. So you get so much energy in one small poem. I'm going to tell them a little bit about who you are, but you'll find out a lot more because I'm just learning in the last 5 minutes that you can speak five languages, which and translate poetry in all of those languages.
Thank you.
Abhay K. is the author of two memoirs. His life apparently has been twice as rich as most people, and he has seven poetry collections. He's editor of Capitals, and that's a Bloomsbury collection that puts out really physically beautiful books, and also the book 100 Great Indian Poems by Bloomsbury, and he's received the Sark Literary Award for 2013, and his poems have appeared in many literary magazines. But more importantly is his voice, and that is what we want to hear. One more poem.
I take you to St. Petersburg, Russia, where I spent 5 years. Anna Akhmatova, your requiems, meditations, condemned and censored. Your loved ones disappeared one by one, without a trace. Lovers and husbands came your way like storms. Gumilev, Modigliani, Mandelstam. Friends left you for greener pastures, and you turned into a poem without a hero.
What is the last line again?
And you turned, friends left you for greener pastures, and you turned into a poem without a hero.
That is something else. You are really a very unusual and special poet. Tell me a little bit about your studies in India, in the university. What was your, were you majoring in English? Were you majoring in literature, philosophy? What is your background?
I studied geography at the university, which surprises most of the people. Also in post-graduation, I studied geography. I have not formally studied literature, but I did take a course at the University of Iowa, an online course in writing poetry.
Well, poets are born, they're not made, and I think you are surely wired as a poet. You have come here today from Brazil, where you are in the diplomatic corps. You were born in India, you were in the diplomatic embassy in St. Petersburg, Russia. You're on your way to Mexico tomorrow. Tell us a little bit about these places. First, which has been the most favorable one to live?
I have lived and enjoyed each and every place I have been to, because I feel the whole planet is my home. I don't have this sense of a foreign country. So wherever I go, I feel as I belong to that place.
But can you get Indian food in Russia?
Yes, very much in everywhere nowadays.
But you're with the embassies in each one of these countries.
Yes, yes.
And take us back to your beginning. Where were you born?
I was born in a district called Nalanda in the east of India, the state of Bihar. And I was born in a small village by a river called Paimar. And I started studying in the government schools, you know, primary school, secondary school. In the high school, I was at a nearby town called Rajgir. And then I worked my way up to the state capital, Patna. And then I came to India's capital, Delhi.
Do you feel you were an exceptional student, or that the school system was quite exceptional? Do you feel that your education is partly because of your circumstances or because of your personal qualities?
I think both, because my father was a teacher. He was a teacher in a primary school at the village. And he was completely devoted to education, not only education of his children, but also the education of the whole village, in the sense he sort of inspired other villagers to send their kids to the school. And
was it optional whether or not the children went to school?
Those days it was optional. So he did his best that children from children of our neighbors, they went to school. So he made that, he tried to persuade them that, you know, if you educate your children.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah.
And I mean, and the schooling system was very good in the sense that I have studied throughout in those schools. And
you have a remarkable fund of knowledge. So it's partly, I think, what you came with and partly what they gave you. Just in one sentence, what was the village like? Was it a beautiful place?
It was a beautiful place, you know, living with nature, where you could go out and play with kids. I mean, in cities, you don't find other kids to play with you. But in village, you could just go out in the evening.
Have your parents known about your poetry?
Yes, my mother, who is still alive, I send her a copy of my new books, and she gets delighted seeing the covers.
And your new book is The Prophecy of Brazil?
Yes, that's my latest book.
And then you have The Eight-Eyed Lord of Kathmandu.
Yes.
And an anthology.
Yes, 100 Great Indian Poems, which I edited, published this year.
Just this year.
Yes.
This is Abhay K. with more poetry. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
I should read a poem. It's called Shanti Path, which means the path of peace. It's a road in New Delhi where embassies are located. Crows on lamp posts caw with unknown sadness, bidding farewell to the setting sun. A flock of parrots rockets across the clear sky. Trees abudge with chirps of mynas. There, two rows of embassies, as two banks of the river of peace, flow to the world capitals from Raisina Hill.
So these embassies, although they are stately marble pillars of diplomacy, still have a kind of a beating heart in your poem.
Yes, I see them as sort of the banks of a river of peace, and the road as a river. So, and that flows from Raisina Hill is like Capitol Hill, where India's president lives, the secretariats are located.
You've been in the diplomatic corps how long?
It's been 15 years since I joined the Indian Foreign Service.
And how many countries?
I have served in Russia, in Nepal, and in Brazil.
And what was daily life like in Russia?
Russia was, the first thing that comes to mind, my mind is lots of snow.
That's exactly what I think too.
And also lots of darkness, because it's dark for a long period of time. But then also this inner sense of illumination, because when the light goes outside, your inner light starts, it gets lighted, you know.
Your inner light.
Yes.
I wish we could say that of everyone.
Yes. So I think it was, I mean, I wrote a lots of poems in Russia, and my first three books are based there.
Well, that's interesting. So you must have actually had more solitude or more time there.
Yes. In fact, I wrote my first memoir after arriving in Moscow.
Why are there two memoirs? Are they chronological?
No, one memoir is about my first 25 years of life, how I grew up in a village, and how education and democracy has brought changes, great changes in India.
Oh, that would be fascinating.
And the second memoir is about my time spent with artists in St. Petersburg. I'm also a painter.
I know.
And I spent a lot of time with artists painting and looking at their work and interacting with them. So at the end of my tenure in St. Petersburg, I wrote a small memoir about the art life of St. Petersburg.
What's the title?
It's called Colors of Soul.
Well, this is Abhay K, and he is a man of the world, but the world is also within him. So we want to hear another poem.
So I take back you to Delhi, and this is a poem called Parikrama, and it's a name of a restaurant, which is a revolving restaurant. Parikrama means revolution, I mean revolving. Parikrama. My eternal city, every midnight I see you. With clear eyes, cherish your contours, your changing skyline, your shimmering lights, your shades of darkness. I sense your changing mood, your lingering lust for blood and wealth, and your deadliest addiction. Power.
I guess as a diplomat, you have a healthy knowledge of what power can do. But how do you describe diplomacy? Is it not to soften the earth?
President JFK, John F. Kennedy said, when power corrupts, poetry cleanses. And I think this sense of balance is very important. The balance of hard and soft. Poetry represents the humane side of human beings, the soft side of human beings, the gentle side of human beings. And I think also makes us aware of the limitations of power.
And I believe you bring a great contribution to that field of diplomacy and poetry. I would like to know how your art affects your writing. I think you are a sculptor as well, right?
I'm a painter, not...
Oh, a painter.
Yes.
And is it oil paints?
Yes, mostly oil paints. Most of my paintings are symbolic in the sense they represent a new age, a new consciousness, what I call planetary consciousness, that we as human beings are as much part of the planet or belong to the planet as much we belong to our villages, towns, and cities. And nations.
And you see the planet as your village.
And I see planet as my home. I see it as a beautiful home going freely in space. That's why I call it a cosmic oasis. Because if you look around in cosmos, it's vast and it's desert. There's nothing out there. 9 planets, no life on other planets. But you have Earth, which is like a huge oasis in the vast desert of cosmos.
Is there a good art scene in Russia?
Yes, very good art scene in Russia. Russia is very rich in, I think, has great artists.
Abhay K is bringing us a wealth, and part of it is on the page. So let us hear.
I would take you to one of my favorite 18th century poets of Delhi, Ghalib. And it begins with a little quote from his poem, which is engraved on his tomb. Na tha kuch to khuda tha, na hota kuch to khuda hota, duboya mujhko honi ne, na hota main, to kya hota? Which translates as, when there was nothing, there was God. If there was nothing, there would have been God. Being has ruined me. If I did not exist, what would have been? And the poem, months of journey on bullock cart, palki, boat, tanga, ekka, and what not. Delhi, Kanpur, Lucknow, Allahabad, Banaras, Banda, Patna, Murshidabad. Finally, Calcutta. Then an endless wait to petition Lord Amherst. Double my paltry pension of rupees 62. I returned to Shahzahabad, scorned, derided, my family debt-ridden, my dignity robbed. My brother died in my arms. None of my sons survived. I turned into a stone, wrapped in human skin. Then came the worst, the massacre of Delhi. My friends were butchered. I alone survived to take down their corpses hanging from the trees, from lampposts, to usher them into their graves, to lament my destiny. The massacre of Delhi in 1857 left a large population of Delhi dead, and Ghalib was a leading poet of his generation at the court of the last Mughal emperor. And this is a poem about his life, what happened to him.
It's a stunning poem. Who perpetrated the disaster?
This disaster happened because of the historical circumstances. It was the last Mughal emperor who was still there, and the East India Company was already marching ahead. And this 1857, there was in 1857 a massacre. It's a famous or infamous massacre of Delhi.
Of the old regime and the new regime?
Regime, yes, in which a lot of people died. It was followed by removal of the last Mughal emperor from the throne.
I see. A coup d'etat? And worse.
and the British took over in 1857. The British crown, British queen took over the reins.
The colonists came.
Yes.
Now we know the transition.
Yes.
Yes.
So it's that critical period of, and Ghalib was alive that time.
Very, very significant turning point in history for India.
Yes.
Yes. And Abhay K is here to tell you about things of the world and things of the heart. And here's another poem.
I would take you to Borges, back in Latin America. I have been traveling, I've been living in Latin America since past 3 years.
Did you learn Spanish by virtue of living there?
I learned Portuguese because I've been living in Brazil, and I speak Portuguese now.
Because of living there?
Yes.
So you learned Russian because of living there?
Yes.
I see.
And Nepali, when I was staying in Nepal. One poem from Nepal, so that I cover Nepal as well. And it's a famous festival of Dasain, which lasts 10 days long and is a major festival of Nepal.
And you've been there?
I was in Nepal for 3.5 years, from 2012 to 2015. And this is a poem, Dasain. It's also celebrated in many parts of India as Dasehra. Barley seeds sown in a bed of sand, thick wick butter lamps lit in every home, spring swings everywhere, ecstatic children know no greater joy. Yellow barley leaves have arrived in a palanquin from Gorkha to Kathmandu. Goats tethered in every courtyard bleat beneath kukri's slas. Army officers command the sacrifice of buffaloes. Big guns are ready to fire off booming rounds. Military bands play war tunes to appease bloodthirsty Kali. Streams of blood flow from temples and courtyards. Relatives arrive from far, a mix of bright vermilion, curd and rice shine on their foreheads with a dash of coal drawn from the soot of butter lamps. The doors of Taleju open today. Revelries will linger on till the full moon.
Does that festival still occur?
Yes, it happens every year. It's a major festival of Nepal.
And they still sacrifice the animal?
Yes. Yes, that's correct.
And what is the purpose of the sacrifice?
It's to appease the goddess Kali.
Mm-hmm. Let's have another.
I would take you to Latin America, Borges, and it begins with a quote. I know of one Greek labyrinth, which is a single straight line. Along that line, so many philosophers have lost themselves. Jorge Luis Borges, Death and the Compass. Poem. Looking for Borges, I came to Argentina. I found him nowhere. I searched all the libraries, all the labyrinthine streets of Buenos Aires. He was not even at La Recoleta Cemetery. I found merely a mirror and a face staring at me in disbelief. It's hard to believe. Everyone told me Borges lived in Argentina.
We have come, unfortunately, to the end of our program. Will you read us a final poem?
Thank you, Grace. I would like to end this with Earth Anthem. I have been trying to get an anthem for our beautiful planet, and I wrote an anthem in 2008.
Tell us about that. Tell us about the process and what's happened to it.
Since then, it's been translated into more than 30 languages, global languages, and it's used by several schools across the world to celebrate Earth Day, World Environment Day, and any other global event where we need a common symbol, a common gathering point for all of us. And it's been composed by a violinist like Dr. L. Subramanyam, and it's been put to also set to orchestra, and Philharmonic Orchestra of Brasilia has performed it.
Was that thrilling to hear?
Yes, and if I can share the anthem, the words of the anthem which I wrote in 2008 when I was in St. Petersburg, Russia. Earth Anthem. Our cosmic oasis, cosmic blue pearl, the most beautiful planet in the universe. All the continents and all the nations, united we stand as flora and fauna. United we stand as species of one earth. Diverse cultures, beliefs, and ways. We are humans. Earth is our home. All the people and all the nations, one for all and all for one. United we unfurl the blue marble flag.
The last line again.
United we unfurl the blue marble flag.
The blue marble flag.
Yes, that's blue marble is an image of Earth taken from Apollo. And this was the first image of Earth taken from space, which we could see. And when I saw that, you know, our beautiful planet from space, I could not stop writing a poem. And how beautiful is our planet? And this is all we have. There's no second home for us. This is ours. This is a beautiful home we have. And we today, with climate change and ecological crisis we face, the pollution we face, we must work together to preserve this beautiful planet.
That is the voice of Abhay K. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation, with additional support from the Sinipid Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
Broadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. This program features poets reading from their works and talking about their craft. And today from New York is Kimiko Hahn, and here she is with a poem.
Thank you. I'll be reading from my book, Toxic Flora. And by and large, these poems are triggered by science articles from the New York Times. The search for names. The right to name Planet X belonged to the Lowell Observatory, where the Kansas farm boy engaged to photograph night heavens using a blink comparator, quickly suggested Slipher after his superior. The widow, Constance Lowell, suggested Zeus, Lowell, and Constance. Then 11-year-old Venetia Burney put forward Pluto, ruler of the underworld, as well a dark and cold terrain, and a god who could turn invisible. She was eating breakfast with her grandfather, Falconer Madden, when he read about the search in the dailies. Lucky girl, fortunate planet, exultant netherworld.
The voice of Kimiko Hahn. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Here's what critics say about you. They praise your experimentation and your traditional Western and Asian verse forms and your brilliant use of formal and free verse structure and the fact that you delve explicitly into a number of critical subjects, including female sexuality, death and loss, the nature of consciousness, motherhood, family love, memory. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I'm very grateful that people have read my work to the extent where they can really find those elements across my books. I would say that's true. I'm a bit of a magpie. I like to take from the world around me and connect it to whatever is going on in the world inside me. So whether it's science or black lung disease or Orientalism from Flaubert's sex tours to Egypt, or whether it's from my own childhood, of course.
And you're also cited for poetry which is about empowerment or disempowerment. What does that mean?
Well, I like to look at things in terms of pairs. So if I'm looking at a sex worker, for example, and she's disempowered, I try and look for the opposite in whatever is going on around her or what has happened after her. So that's important to me.
That is a good lesson, isn't it, for writers?
I hope so.
Is that what you teach your writers?
That is what I teach my writers and my literature students.
That is a nice axiom to carry away. So let's have another poem. Kimiko Han, we're at the Library of Congress, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.
On Deceit as Survival. Darwin could not believe an insect would visit a blossom that had no reward, and insisted that the green-winged orchid must withhold its nectar deep inside. But he was deceived as well, since this orchid does not offer nectar in its own Darwinian desire to attract then rid itself of the useful bee. Still others smell like feces or carrion for the sort that prefers to lay eggs in such environs. Yet another species resembles a female bumblebee ending in frustrated trysts, or appears to be two fractious males, which also attracts, no surprise, a third curious enough to join the fray. What to make of highly evolved beauty bent on deception as survival? Liposuction, rejuvenated clitoris, plumped lips. I plead with daughters to forget the enhanced buttocks and rely on soap as fragrance. But how can a mother instruct on deceit when girls so readily flaunt thigh and thong, and when parking lots are replete with broken fences and the preternatural buzz of the car alarm?
Kimiko Han, she is the child of artists, a Japanese-American mother from Hawaii and a German-American father from Wisconsin. And what were their arts?
They were both visual artists. Soon after they met in Chicago after the war, my father was at the Art Institute and my mother was at Gregg's Secretarial School and taking art classes. They met and began creating jewelry together. And my father went on to paint oil paintings and then calligraphy.
And Kimiko is in Washington now for a show tonight at the George Washington University, which puts photographers and poets together in composition, design, and form. So you do carry out your aesthetics. And your undergraduate degree was from Iowa?
Yes.
And then your master's was from
Columbia University.
Columbia. And you are now a distinguished professor.
At Queens College, City University of New York. I'm a great CUNY booster, so I want to put that in
there.
Say
it twice.
That's right.
And of all your prizes, the Shelley Memorial Prize is truly time-honored, and that must have made you feel very, very good.
Completely, yeah.
And what was that for?
That was for, I believe, a poet who is has a great deal of work behind them and promises to write more good stuff.
So we're going to fulfill that promise today. Okay. Kimiko Han, why did you choose this book of all of your books to read today?
Well, there is a Japanese aesthetic informing these poems, even though it doesn't seem like it, and also informing the, again, science-triggered poems in my forthcoming book, Brain Fever. I like to use words, I like to make words work really hard, and part of Japanese poetics is to use a lot of multiple meanings. So if I can find a word that has multiple meaning, it becomes a kind of portal. So I can go from science and move into other areas. And that is so much fun. And I've really been, Toxic Flora has really enabled me to sharpen that, and then Brain Fever moving on and really play around.
You are a hard worker, aren't you? What are you the most stubborn about in your writing?
Endings, closure. And I've been teaching craft classes to my graduate MFA students on poetic closure, which is a book written by a scholar a number of years ago, and I've taken that book to heart.
You just sum up in one sentence what is poetic closure that makes it so significant?
It is looking at the way repetition forms in a poem, any kind of repetition, whether it's imagery, sound, etc., and how the ending bears out the repetition, either confirming that or deviating from it.
Let us hear another poem.
Thank you. I'll read this villanelle. The Fever. The coral reefs are changing color, the black and crimson bleached away. The ocean's rising fever, in every drop the sea's over, damages the membrane of symbiotic algae, and coral reefs change their color. True, it's less sensational than acts of terror. True, we can slather sunblock than sunbathe, despite the ocean's rising fever. After all, the planet isn't boiling over. Algae is not an inflamed country. It's just coral reefs changing color. I wonder if it's yet again the ozone layer, ruined by my aunt's persistent use of hairspray, this ocean's rising fever. I already own my share of vivid jewelry from mother's childhood village on Maui. Still, the living are losing color in my ocean's escalating fever.
Why not tell everyone what a villanelle is?
A villanelle is a form where in the first stanza, the first and the third lines are repeated in subsequent stanzas as the third line.
Okay, that's enough.
Okay.
I know everyone is going crazy now, but they just had to know that there was a scheme there, because the reason I wanted you to do that to our poor listeners is it is so flawless when you read it, and it is so embedded and so effortless that you do not know there is a rigid structure, and that's the secret, so that it doesn't look like a piece of marble.
Right, thank you.
And I wanted them to know what you went through to get there. And let's have another poem.
Okay. Having said that, I'll read from a section I call Reckless Sonnets, which is to say they just barely follow the form of a sonnet.
And what would you say was a form of a sonnet?
14 lines, usually a love poem, usually a strict rhyme scheme, and iambic pentameter. I don't do all those things,
okay.
So it's pretty rough, except for the progression. And usually there's a kind of shift called a volta towards the end. These poems were triggered by a book on extinct birds. Conuropsis carolinensis. A small green parrot named Incus, the last of its kind, died in the Cincinnati Zoo a week after Valentine's Day, 1918, barely surviving Lady Jane, his mate of 32 years. The only parrots to adapt to unkind North American winters, hundreds would consume entire fruit farms. The birds were shot to protect such crops, as well for sport and for their sultry feathers, suitable for ladies' hats. Hovering and squawking, rather than abandon the dead, they made an easy target. How hunters care less, and oh, how one falls extinct for love. I recall my mother's untold affection.
Extinct for love. That's great.
I have a second one I'd like to read from this sequence. Pinguinus impennis. Large, flightless, and defenseless, the great auk was captured for feathers, for feather beds, hunters loosening the plumage in cauldrons, fueled with the oil from the freshly killed auk before them. After the 1830 volcanic eruption in Iceland, after museums and collectors vied for the near extinct penguin of the north, in 1844, the last pair was beaten to their deaths, and their solitary egg dashed on the rocks of Elde Island. Could we not sleep on straw or goose down? What dreams are worth such extinction? And are they dreams I'd wish to own?
I think that I was going to ask you what propels you towards science, but now I've changed my thought to how you imbue science with compassion. Is that your purpose?
Well, I'll try and answer both questions. One thing that attracts me to science or to any outside source material is the language itself. As I was saying before, when there's a rich language, a kind of textured language, if you will, the sounds, even the way the words look on a page, I'm very attracted to play with the text, wherever it comes from, play with the source. I think it's pretty popular now for poets to use outside sources.
Right.
But my rule of thumb is, for myself and for my students and my friends, for that matter, is to encourage people really to find what their stake is, to find what their stake is in the material. So for me, my stake is, on the one hand, very simply loss, bereavement, grief.
And that is where I saw the compassion, because otherwise it would be reportage.
Yes,
very exactly. Nicely designed reportage, and that is the distinct difference. So it comes out very overtly, I think, especially when you hear it.
Thank you.
Let's hear another.
Okay.
Kimiko Hahn at the Library of Congress.
The Blob. In 1896, nearly 50 years after Melville's masterpiece, 3 years before Freud's dream and my grandpa's journey across the Pacific, a storm shoved 7 tons of white blob onto a St. Augustine shore, 23 monstrous feet of glistening flesh, a surviving archaist or alien or devil of the deep. Chunks were immediately shipped to the nascent Smithsonian for display then storage. Until 100 years later, a Florida scientist examining the same specimen as well as new blobs floated up from the depths, declaring the cryptozoological curios merely the remains of large cetaceans. The narrative of the stupefying has closed with nothing more than pure collagen, washed up from the ocean's unconscious, sad to say.
So we have your subject matter, and if we were to ask you how you retell a lived experience, and I consider observation a lived experience, mm-hmm. and how you change that to poetry, can you quickly tell us a process? It's an experience of observation, absorption, and then how does it make that leap to poetry?
I'm a real believer in getting to raw material, just playing, as I said, playing with words and just getting things down on the page or the screen, as the case may be, and then letting go of the material and then coming back and finding where the poem is, mm-hmm. the richest moments in the poem, what the themes might be. I may have started with one thing and end up with another. So find where the poem is going and then attempt to revise towards that. Does that answer your question?
It does.
Oh, good.
It does very well. And I think it also is a pattern that many writers disclose because
right.
it's the discovery.
Right.
You're saying first, though, get it down. Get it on the page. You know, our students are so afraid to break that white surface of the page.
Yes.
Just get it down first, you're saying.
Yes.
And then find the hot center there.
Right, exactly.
But what level of inquiry would you like from your reader? Would you like them to just like it, to understand it, to be further interested in the subject? What would you like?
I would like my readers to experience the poem. As a literature professor, I know all too well that it's oftentimes taught as a lesson. You know, read Emily Dickinson. Here's a lesson. And by the way, it will be on the exam. I have a friend who is a therapist, and she kids me as a professor. She said, oh, you professors feel things from the neck up. And of course, as a poet and as a professor, I want to use my whole body to feel things because that's art. You want to be moved by art. So that is what I would hope for my own modest work, that it will move people, that people will actually experience it.
And feel it.
Yes.
And give us another.
Thank you.
Tell us the name of the book again.
The book is Toxic Flora.
And who put that out?
And this came out by W.W. Norton and Company.
And they're doing your new book.
They are doing my new book, Brain Fever.
Very, very loyal.
Yes, they are. Sedna. Come to find out, Sedna is the Inuit woman whose father cast her from their kayak, thus transforming her into the spirit of the sea, but also the name of 2003 VB12, a planet or something beyond Pluto. It is the first body to be discovered in the Oort cloud, a hypothetical region of icy objects that become comets. But questions remain. How can a region be hypothetical? How can a scientist not know what a planet is? How could a father throw his daughter from a kayak, even if she did write poetry that hurt his feelings? I am not sorry. He always said, art comes first. But that is a murky region for fathers and daughters, what comes first. Mm. And what my daughters wish to know is, did she drown for his sake or to learn how depths betray?
So you found the center in that poem.
Yes.
Here are her other books. She has 8 collections of poetry, including the one we're listening to now, Toxic Flora. The others are The Narrow Road to the Interior, The Artist's Daughter, Mosquito and Ant, Volatile, and The Unbearable Heart, which received an American Book Award. She's received many awards, fellowships from the Guggenheim, the National Endowment for the Arts, the New York Foundation for the Arts, the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Writers Award, the Theodore Retke Memorial Poetry Prize, and the Association of Asian American Studies Literature Award. Is that enough for you? Will you stop now already? What is it you want? What is it you want?
I just want to keep writing poems.
That's what Howard Nimrov said.
And move people.
Nimrov said, bring them on, bring them on.
That's great.
And so I'm Grace Cavalieri, and she's Kimiko Hahn, and we're together at the Library of Congress. And tonight she'll be at George Washington University, and they will be presenting wonderful photographs adorned with the poetry of these poets, one of whom is Kimiko. And let's hear another poem.
The Soul. Quote, I addicted myself to the opening of heads, end quote. Thomas Willis. A physician of King Charles II, Willis was intrigued by the curious quilted ball, receiver of animal electricity, but could not bring himself to identify the brain as the bodily home of the soul. But why cite region on behalf of invisible impulse? What prompts one child to warn her mother that she doesn't want to read about her affairs with boys and muscle cars, but that she is gladdened to know the collections will survive her as a keepsake of extreme explanation? And prompts the other to write so viciously of family vacations the father renounces her. Why open the skull as daily enterprise? Why research what is transparent? Why not see the soul for what it is, that sideswipe, that riptide, that addiction to human remains?
Great, Les. Terrific closure. Good
Thank
example
you.
For your class.
Thank you.
If you were called a poetry of witness, what would you be witnessing? What do you think would people... What do they mean when they say that about you? What are you noticing?
Well, you mentioned early power and empowerment and disempowerment or powerlessness. I think that that is something as a woman, as a person of color, as a teacher, as a mother, daughter, in all the facets of my life, I'm acutely aware of what the struggle is for individuals. I mean, everyone. But I'm just talking about my own experience and what I witness. It's a curious paradox. My students in my undergraduate classes always want to write very abstract poems because they want everybody to identify with the poem. And the paradox is, in my mind, that the more detailed and clear it is to my experience, the more I can invite a person in and they can experience the theme. So if the theme is betrayal, I invite that person in, and maybe they haven't been betrayed by, say, a beloved, but they know what betrayal is in their life, as large or small as that may be. So I don't know if that's an answer, but that's what I just thought of.
It is a very distinct and discreet answer, I think. But I consider writers having a moral life, and mm-hmm. I believe that is because they have certain ethics about what they won't write about. Are there some areas you just will not go into because it's just not right?
I have mentioned my daughters in these poems, and I have taken poetic license. So actually, what I write about them is really more about my own girlhood. I do not want to write about their personal lives. That's really...
I agree.
That's my difficulty.
I feel...
Everyone else...
But that isn't...
Open.
I don't think that is a difficulty, though. That's a moral stance.
Mm-hmm.
I'm writing my memoir right now, and I'm not telling the burdens that my children have struggled with in their lives, which we all have.
Right.
That is not for me to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the reader hasn't earned that.
Oh, that's,
you know,
interesting.
That isn't earned by them. But I can still be as truthful as possible, as you have been.
Mm-hmm.
Just slant.
Right.
Little slant.
Yeah, slant.
You know, who needs to write about their children's sex lives, for example?
Right.
What? We don't need that, really, do we? Are we that bereft of subject matter?
Right.
So I'm glad we agree.
Yeah.
Let us have another.
I was just going to respond to that and say, my friend, well-known novelist Walter Mosley,
mm-hmm.
once told me, as I was complaining and sounding like my students, he said, well, why don't you just write it all down and you can decide later whether you're going to publish it or not or revise it or not. And I just thought, you know, I say that to my students, and thank you, Walter, for saying it to me.
We'll be right back. You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy viernes 19 de mayo del 2023. Las Naciones Unidas advierten que es probable que los próximos 5 años sean los más cálidos registrados, con repercusiones de gran alcance para la salud, la seguridad alimentaria, la gestión del agua y el medio ambiente. La Organización Meteorológica Mundial de la ONU dijo el miércoles que los gases de efecto invernadero que atrapan el